Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/Japan.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Dema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. I hope everyone who's listening to the show is safe and well and in good spirits. And our studio is currently closed due to the outbreak of COVID-19 caused by coronavirus in New York City and all over the world. So I'm recording this episode remotely from my apartment in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guests today are Rich Shi and Jeremy Umansky, who just wrote a very interesting book on koji, the title of which is Koji Alchemy, Rediscovering the Magic of Mold-Based Fermentation. And I believe it released today. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I guess it depends where you buy it from.
Okay. Yes, I'm going to say the six. I was wondering. But yeah. So anyway, so koji is the national mold of Japan. And it is used to make almost all fermented products in Japanese cuisine, such as miso, soy sauce, and sake and shochu, you name it. And koji is also becoming a culinary keyword lately. And top chefs in the world, such as Werner Redzepi and Fern Adria, have been actively using koji in very innovative ways. So I keep hearing from chefs in New York that they're experimenting with it and making their own koji-based products also. So, and Jeremy joined me on episode 135 and discussed his mind-blowing and effective ways to use koji. So today we'll discuss what is covered in the new book, Koji Alchemy, from what koji is, what it is so why it is so special and powerful in producing great flavors, how to use it in both traditional and modern preparations, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And also, please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Rich Shi and Jeremy Umansky. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So this is exciting. I've been talking about koji very excitedly always. In I don't know how many months ago it started. But so it's amazing. Your book finally came out and we're going to discuss everything about it. It's amazing. Good book. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first of all, how are you doing in this crazy unrealistic reality that you're living in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm here, doing fairly well, still going into the office every now and then, safely, socially distanced as much as possible, and just sort of trying to take it day by day and looking at the positive side of things. And I think the amazing thing is just being able to spend time with my family more so than I had before.
Right. What about you, Jeremy?
Hanging in there. It's just like everybody. This is crazy, right? just trying to adjust. Our restaurant, we did have to close for about 3.5 weeks, but we were able to reopen just about 3 weeks ago. Business is somewhere between good and bad, but we're hanging in there. We're actually really excited because tomorrow, this coming Tuesday, we're actually able to bring back a couple of our full-time employees. So, which is good that, it makes things kind of feel more normal and gives us hope for the future.
Right. Oh, that's a very big first step for recovery.
Yes.
Right. So, so let's talk about your background first. So where you're from and what do you do? First, Rich?
Hi. I live just north of Boston, and I work as a mechanical engineer during the day and sort of a culinary adventurer in the rest of my waking hours. pretty much I'm really into fermentation and koji, obviously, and I teach workshops every now and then to people who are interested in the subject. Been sharing ideas on food for a while now, and really enjoy that interaction in terms of people working together to learn more and gain knowledge about cultures and foods and how we can, kind of move ahead and develop some interesting things.
Mm. Yeah, I think I can guess you are an engineer because you're very analytical in your book. So,
yeah, I think we have a good combination of strengths that we're able to bring different perspectives together to create a book that works for a large number of people.
Mm. Right. Okay. So what about you, Jeremy? What's your background?
Well, one thing really quick, Rich develops spy satellites.
What?
I don't develop spy satellites.
That's about all I know about Rich, what he does in the rest of his life. He told me if I wanted to know more about what his job really is, that
Wow. So we need another episode to discover what he does and how he connects the satellite and the koji.
Well, he's such a fascinating man.
Well, yeah, no
it's
question.
Not that exciting, really.
So I was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, in the Midwest. Ended up spreading my wings for a little bit, lived in New York City in the Hudson Valley. I am a trained chef. I went to culinary school. I have a wonderful...
You went to CIA, so Harvard Culinary School, CIA. You're the graduate.
And that's where I met my beautiful wife, Anne, she's now my business partner in my restaurant here in Cleveland. So after being in New York, which I love, I absolutely love New York. A huge part of my heart will always be there. We came back to Cleveland, and we have a delicatessen now, like a Jewish deli, Eastern European deli, where we make pastrami with koji and rye bread with koji. That's where I am nowadays.
Right. So we're going to get into what you do in a moment too. So, but how did you get into koji and how did you become experts of the mold to the level of writing such a great book? So first, Rich?
I got into koji just through a chef friend of mine who understood that I had this technical background and kind of mindset to learn things. And he was working on a... showcasing ferments from around the world for a brunch. And he asked me one day to research koji. And I did so by just doing some internet research and, picking up some papers and understanding that it really wasn't that hard to do to get spores to grow. All you needed to do was build a very simple incubator. And that's what I did. And then once I started playing with it, and understanding that I could apply it to just about anything with protein or starch to create really delicious and interesting flavors, I just started to put it up against whatever starch or protein I was interested in testing and came out with some pretty pretty fun things and found out that it was really a really fast process in terms of some particular proteins. Like if you apply to dairy, you can get complex aged cheese flavors in the order of a couple months. And then I just kept adventuring, sharing my ideas, and that's how I connected to Jeremy.
Wow. Okay. So what about you, Jeremy?
Yeah. I working in restaurants, the chef I was working with had asked me to make miso. They brought me this great book, the Book of Miso, and they said, hey, we want to incorporate some of these foods, and can you do this? And I said, sure. And I really didn't know much about koji at that point. I knew a little bit that there were these molds, these fungi used in some ferments in Asia. But that was the extent. And at this time too, I was pretty involved with making fermented foods and cured meats. And stuff that I taught people and other chefs how to do. And when I was asked to make this miso, it just opened up a whole floodgate for me. I got super interested in koji, especially too. I do a lot of work with wild mushrooms, identifying them and teaching people how to use them and this sort of thing. So already having this background in mycology, being introduced to a mold that I could work with in the kitchen, I just took off running. It was just absolutely fascinating to me.
Wow. So, well, I don't know, question that you have just common interest, but how did you guys meet and decided to work on a book on koji together?
Yeah. So Rich and I, both kind of independently of each other, were sharing the work that we were doing on different social media platforms. Eventually the two of us kind of linked up, and I was really intrigued by his work and he was intrigued by mine. And we started this great, I'm going to call it a romance.
Don't tell my wife.
It's transcended friendship at this point. I love him. I love him like he's a brother. We developed this relationship, and just started feeding off of each other and spurring each other's creativity and helping each other grow more with the mold as we learned about it. And it eventually got to a point, a mutual friend of ours, Cynthia Graber, she has a great show called Gastropod. She had interviewed Rich for, I believe, the Boston Globe about some meat coats he was making. And he recommended that she see my work, which then she traveled to Cleveland to do. And she really hammered home how, after seeing both of our work and kind of tasting the foods we were making, she really hammered home to me personally how much that Rich and I needed to be friends and we needed to find a way to work together.
Interesting. Because I think you, both of you, have very objective and analytical view to koji, and me being Japanese, it's always something associated with traditional food products. So it's really fascinating that two different minds got together and then just came up with something really interesting. So let's talk about the new book. Again, the title is Koji Alchemy, Rediscovering the Magic of Mold-Based Fermentation. So what is the theme and what do you cover in the book?
Rich, why don't you start?
Sure. I mean, I think for us, the core theme was to be able to show people how to utilize koji in all these amazing ways, but very basically and simply without, having any sort of predisposition of it being difficult to do. As it is a mold, most people's experiences with mold aren't necessarily favorable. It's one of those things that people... If you talk about food with mold, they tend to just want to throw it away and get rid of it. Whereas this very specific mold, Aspergillus oryzae, brings us beautiful things, makes things delicious. So we wanted to make it approachable. And we also wanted to make the book very practical in terms of understanding and basic ideas so people could just you know, understand a principle or a base recipe and make it their own. And I think the other thing that we tried to do that was important to us was tie everything together such that people could understand how to work with enzymes, because that's sort of the primary purpose behind using Koji, because it's the highest loaded enzyme product that one can produce very easily in just a simple cooking environment or just in your home, in opposed to, you know, anything else that has an enzyme, in terms of, you know, large scale food production or the amount of enzymes. You really have to, you know, have it, you know, be a very specific process with lots of, you know, crazy equipment. So it's got a lot of enzyme punch to be able to create amazing flavors. And we just wanted to make people put something in front of people that no matter what level you were at in terms of cooking, you could just open the book and start working and understand what we were doing.
Akiko, to kind of expound on that a little bit, we wanted this book to be a cornerstone of creativity. So a lot of the problems that Rich and I observed with, we felt there wasn't an English language resource solely devoted to Koji. And that was a problem we wanted to solve. We, you know, whether the book was written by us or somebody else eventually, we felt there needed to be a resource out there. So we set out to do it. The other things that we wanted to do was, in terms of cookbooks, a lot of cookbooks don't necessarily spur creativity. They give you wonderful insight into brilliant chefs and these fabulous culinary minds and their restaurants and what they're doing and how they work. But they don't necessarily teach you how to do that in your own restaurant or your own home. So in this book, we do have a few base recipes, but a lot of the time we spend explaining how this works so people, as Rich said, of any level can then take this information and be as creative and as adventurous and as inquisitive as they individually want to be, which allows Koji to be deeply personal for any individual. It allows for what you make with Koji in your home or your restaurant to be so unique compared to what I'm doing or Rich or anybody else. So that was something that was super, super important to us in making this book and writing about it.
Right. The other part I was fascinated by this book is that, you know, it's very collaborative, and you have so many people, so many chefs from the fermentation community, and show their own creativity. So it's really inspiring for whoever reads this. Maybe you can come up with something on your own. That's like a natural motivation from the book, I think.
Yeah, and you know, it was important for us too to have a variety of voices. So we have different chefs, we have scientists, we have Koji spore producers, we have Higuchi-san and from Japan in the book. We have a cheesemaker, we have a beer brewer, all these different people that use it in different ways. And we were very intentional too, because we didn't want the experience that these people have that they wrote about to necessarily be the same as ours. We wanted to present their story of how they work with it in their voice. So we didn't want to take it and necessarily reinforce how great Koji was, or that, you know, that they use it all the time, even versus special occasions. We didn't want to change any of what they were saying. We wanted to keep it as straightforward as possible so that they could talk about what they're doing with it also.
Right. That's important. Because I heard, so the Higuchi-san is one of the very few, I think there are only five companies who sell Koji spores. And, you know, there are only five because you don't need so many companies to sell the spores, because once you buy it, it's going to grow. And it's just the seeds, right? It's not, you know, something patented. You can keep growing other than, yeah, you know, agricultural seeds. So, yeah, what I heard, Higuchi-san told me one time that the industry of Koji spores that's really suffering because there's no other way to go beyond traditional Japanese food products. And now I think people, talented people like you guys are expanding, it's pushing the envelope. So I'm very hopeful that this book and any other efforts, creative efforts, are helping the industry. And it's really important. So yeah, I'm really excited about what you do.
Well, thank you. And you know, I'm Rich and I, that was a huge goal of ours. You know, we discuss in this book other types of fermentation. Let's say you make sourdough bread. You can save a starter, right? This culture of the microbes that help make that ferment and use it to keep making more, and you can keep growing more of it. And while you can do that to an extent with koji, it can actually be dangerous. Because the koji can mutate and it can become contaminated. While the risk is fairly low for that, it can happen. So we took this approach of support the spore producers in Japan or even other parts of the world that make, you know, in the Philippines, they have their own version of this, in China and Korea and so on and so forth. Support all these individual people who are, they're protecting the biodiversity of koji because there's many different types that do very specialized things. They're reinvesting in its future. And very important too, these are, for the most part, family-run businesses. These are small, independent businesses that are, in a lot of ways, the cornerstones of the communities they exist in. So they create these fabulous products. They keep money in their local communities. They keep strengthening the people around them. You know, it's much different than, you know, sending money to a large conglomerate. So with all of this, with protecting biodiversity, supporting small family businesses, we really wanted people to be able to source koji in a way that you know, benefited everybody.
Right. Yeah, actually, so the Koichi Higuchi of Higuchi Matsunoke Shoten, he's in Osaka. He actually joined me on episode 163, and he's seventh generation of the company. So
yeah, 50 years almost, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So for listeners who are not familiar with koji, so let's just talk about koji. What is koji?
Go ahead, Rich.
Sure. Okay. So traditionally, koji, as the Japanese know it, is a mold inoculated rice or grain. You know, commonly, you know, it would be rice, barley, or soybeans, where you take a specific mold called Aspergillus oryzae, and you basically grow it on a starch medium of the grains that's prepared in a very specific way, such that the starch, the individual grains are gelatinized, but they're not wet and mushy, such that the mold filamentous mold can infiltrate and grow upon it. And then basically you end up yielding enzymes that'll break starches down into sugars and proteins down into amino acids once you apply them to starches or proteins. So simply, koji is just growing a very specific mold on a rice that creates these enzymes to ultimately create all these awesome products like miso, shoyu, mirin, amazake, sake, shochu, as you already mentioned.
Right.
And Akiko, we can kind of look at historically why would somebody use a mold for this, right? Because we all get worried about the black mold in our shower and we have to clean it, or the mold that grows on the food we forgot about in the back of the refrigerator, right? Like, there's these molds that aren't good. So why would somebody use a mold for this? And interestingly enough, if you look at rice itself and you were to try to make alcohol just using rice without growing the mold on the rice, you cannot do it. And the reason for that is rice does not contain these simple sugars that yeast then eats to make alcohol. And the koji mold breaks apart all the starch in the rice into these simple sugars. Mm-hmm. And in the case with soybeans too, soybeans, when they're raw, are not very good for us, actually. We eat edamame and that sort of thing. But compared to other beans that we can eat raw or lightly cooked, the soybeans have to be treated in a way to free up all the nutrients inside them. And there are some cooking processes that do this, but the best way to do it is to actually mix the beans with the mold or grow the mold on the beans. And we end up with foods like miso, which if we compare the nutrients in miso to the nutrients in just a regular kind of maybe steamed soybean, the miso nutrients are 3, 4, 5 times more bioavailable, meaning our body can actually access them when we eat them. Wow. Versus being bound up in a way where our body would just pass it through without actually getting to use it. So this is kind of why, you know, going back thousands of years ago, when people didn't have access to the science and the technology and understanding we do now, why they chose to use this mold. They saw it happened in a natural environment, kind of like a freak accident. Somebody experimented with it. They found out that it could do these things for them, and it made them feel better when they ate these foods. So they established that it was healthier. It also allowed them to preserve the foods for long-term storage without the use of refrigeration. So, you know, Koji is, we talk about these things because it is so, so important in Japan and China and the Koreas and all of Asia. One could make a good argument that those cultures wouldn't have developed into the great civilizations that they are now if it weren't for Koji.
Wow. So, well, this sounds like the Koji is just a magic. And I heard there are over 100 enzymes in Koji. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, it's full of enzymes. And in the book, you introduce 3 main types of enzymes. So maybe you can talk about them.
Sure. I'll start and I'll let Rich finish. You know, for those people that don't understand what an enzyme is, first off, they are types of proteins and they do very specialized things. So very simply, the enzyme responsible for breaking starch, like just plain rices, into the simple sugars that make it up, Koji produces that. The enzyme that breaks apart other types of proteins into the amino acids, amino acids are very tasty and flavorful and umami and delicious, and they're easier for our body to absorb and digest. Koji produces that one. It also produces an enzyme that breaks down fat into very aromatic and pleasant smelling compounds. So those are the 3 main ones, the protease, the amylase, and the lipase. Those are the 3 ones that we mainly pay attention to in the book.
Right. Well, also, I think in the book you describe there is a very unique and attractive smelling koji. So how do you describe it? I think it's coming out of that process of, you know, created by the enzymes, I think.
Yeah, I think each koji, and there's several different types, are unique in the aromas they create. For example, Aspergillus soyae, which is commonly used in the soy sauce making process and even some types of miso, when that grows on beans, whether it's soybeans or white beans or black-eyed peas, I most noticed aromas that are like tropical fruit. It makes the beans smell like mangoes or pineapples. Mm. I mean, it's really fascinating.
I get that often, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, Aspergillus oryzae, which if we would just grow it on rice, depending on the variant, the type of Aspergillus oryzae, some of them smell like the most amazing flowers and potpourri you've ever smelled. Others smell like a mix of like Granny Smith apple and champagne and a little bit of yeast and maybe some slight mushroom aroma. So it's really this wide palette of aromas that they produce. You can even in some of the other species, like Asterios luciensis, which is a brown or a black koji, they actually produce organic acids. They create citric acid, which is very tart. I can pick up on like a sour, not a bad sour smell, but kind of something like a lemon, you know, almost when it's growing. It's just, they're just incredible. To think that mold creates these beautiful, bright, uplifting aromas is just fantastic.
Mm, right. That's the opposite of what we think of a mold. It's just so fragrant. And yeah, once you know it, you just want to have it in your fridge. Like, it's just, they say like a miso, white miso to black miso, they have diversity. And they all have a whole range of the smells that you just described. So the smell is one, the benefit. So what else is, what kind of other benefits of using koji in food?
I think one of the most interesting benefits is something that's been used in Japan for a long time, is just the ability to use it as a marinade to quickly create amino acids by applying it to a piece of protein, whether it be fish or a steak or even just some beans that you've sautéed. That you can have these, you know, these nuances of amino acids, and just to accent the flavor such that the food tastes more like itself. And I think the other side of the coin in terms of usage of amazake to create sweet flavors through a grain, plus all of these interesting aromatics that come along with whichever grain that you apply the koji to, by basically taking some koji, whether you've grown it on a specific grain or not, and then adding it to another grain that you like to have. And one thing that people are really excited about these days is oat milk. If you add koji to oats, cooked oats and a little bit of water, you get one of the most delicious oat milks I've ever had.
Wow.
And it's super great. And you can either add it to your morning porridge, you can strain it out and use it as a milk. You can easily blend it and add a little bit of sugar to make a sorbet, or even mount it into different breads or you know, just your pancakes or anything that you want to add to sugar-wise that you've basically achieved enzymatically instead of buying some processed sugar. It's really fun, and it's a cool process because you're not only creating this very this sweet product, but you also carry along a level of enzymatics from the protease that creates a touch of umami that makes it, you know, just that little hint makes it more delicious than just eating a bowl of oatmeal with some sugar.
Right. So you mentioned umami and the sweetness, definitely. I think one of the enzymes, I think it's called amylase. I think that sweetness, to me, that's my favorite sweetness. It's more complex and it's mild, but very deep. And of course, umami, I think a lot of chefs use koji because of the umami, which is the fifth taste. And fifth taste after salty, sweet, bitter, sour. And then I heard umami enhances all other four tastes, not just umami itself is tasty. So yeah, so koji has all of them. It's just one package. And there's no reason not to use it. So maybe you can give us an example of how to use koji. Let's see. First, the traditional way, like, can you maybe just go through quickly the process of making miso or soy sauce or sake or whatever you pick?
Yeah. And interestingly enough, making soy sauce and making miso are pretty much the same process, except one, the shoyu, the soy sauce, has more water in it than the miso. So first let's start with growing the koji. So you need the spores, which are kind of like the seeds. So what you do is you cook off rice. Traditionally, it is steamed very delicately. The rice is cooked so that none of it sticks together at all. It's almost like the Italians with their pasta, like al dente. once the rice cools to about body temperature, you know, give or take 80 degrees Fahrenheit, you put the spores on, and then you hold the koji in a humid and warm environment, you know, between 70 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit with higher humidity for up to 2 days, and the mold will grow on the rice. The same could be said for if you're doing barley or beans or that sort of thing. You know, so from there, then you have your koji, you have your mold on your substrate. To make a miso, you could approach it many ways, but traditionally they would then take this molded rice, the koji rice, and mix it with salt and cook soybeans and mash everything up together to a paste, pack it into a crock or a vessel, and let it age. Some traditional styles throughout Japan, they use after a matter of days. Others, they let sit for 3, even 5 years before they even go to use them. You know, in the case of making the shoyu, like I said, it's very similar to the miso making process. In miso, where you mix the salt and the koji and the beans together and mash it to a paste, if you were making a shoyu, you would add enough water into it so that it was like a loose soup. Mm. And then that would also sit for a set amount of time. Typically, most shoyu sits for a year. They typically aren't used sooner than that, at least in the traditional sense. And some even go much, much longer, you know, multiple years. So the great thing about them, too, is the actual time that you spend working on them is very little. The time to cook the rice, the time to actually cook the beans and then mix everything together, you're maybe talking about a few hours of hands-on active work. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the time you can sit back and relax and dream about how delicious it'll be when the set time is for it to be eaten.
Right. So that's the koji who does the work. And you just create an environment, and then, yeah, good luck.
In the book, we talk about how you should approach this as being a farmer. You know, the farmer's job is to make sure that the field is right for the animals and for the plants. So they keep the wolves away from the sheep. They keep the weeds away from the plants. They don't do much to the plant to actually get it to grow. They just make sure the environment is okay and safe. And that's your goal when you work with koji. It's very much the same thing.
Mm, right. All right. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about how to use koji in a very innovative way. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its order hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/Japan.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view the exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcast from Live from a Studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guests are Richie and Jeremy Umansky, who just published a very interesting book on koji, and titled which is Koji Alchemy, Rediscovering the Magic of Malt-Based Fermentation. So let's talk about how you can use koji in a very innovative way. So maybe, Jeremy, you can talk about your fungus-crusted meat or whatever you picked.
Which you've gotten to eat before. You ate some veal with it on.
Yeah.
So some of the things that we address in the book are, traditional things that you would find in some Western cuisines, Western European cuisines, like charcuterie making, the making of, salted and dried cured meats. Anything from like a prosciutto to a soppressata salami, using koji in those as opposed to some of the traditional molds that they do use in those. Other things that we worked on and we develop and we address in the book are using koji in some fairly new and novel ways to create more flavorful meats. And one of them is by actually growing the koji on raw meat and then cooking it. And what we found out is that these meats eat, in terms of their texture and their flavor, much like dry aged meat does. So you go to a good steakhouse and they've got the regular steak. Let's say it's $30. And then they have the same cut of meat, but it's been dry aged. That cut of meat is $75. And the difference is in the aged meat, it's more flavorful. It's more tender. It's overall, it's a better product. Not everybody likes dry aged meat. That's one thing to note. But generally speaking, chefs and people that enjoy eating meat consider aged meat to be better. It's more flavorful. It's more tender. So we actually developed techniques where we use koji to do that in under 48 hours compared to a month to a month and a half in the traditional way of doing that. So that's one thing that we've always been really excited about. We feel it's absolutely delicious. Akiko, like I said, you've tried it. So
yep. I'm the witness.
it's fascinating, we feel.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing how quickly, koji can break things down and, make it just delicious because of its direct application of more active enzymes in koji, right?
Yeah, and that's part of why we named the book Koji Alchemy, because it's almost magical. As much as we understand the science and we can quantify it and we can describe what's happening on this level that we can't see, it's still seemingly magical. And that's what's wonderful about it. I think Rich too can, like, Rich has developed some fantastic misos, like his cookie dough miso and some of the aged cheeses that Rich started working early on are just, and he can talk more about them. They're just fascinating.
Right.
I think more recently, one of the things that I have experimented with is just using different protein powders. One protein powder that I found was, fairly awesome was I just found some hemp protein powder. And when I applied some shio koji in the order of the time that you wait for a shio koji to finish sitting at room temperature in about a week, it tasted like seaweed and it was pretty amazing. So I found that, just anything that is highly loaded protein can yield umami fairly quickly, and you don't have to wait that long for it. I mean, it's in the same context of when you apply it to a piece of protein like a steak or, you know, a pork chop and things of that nature, is that you can get enzymes fairly quickly with the enzymatic action to create amino acids fairly quickly. And the other application in understanding that you can apply it to a starch and create, you know, a level of sweetness, is that you can take, you know, less than great, you know, fruit that you can obtain from the grocery store or something that's not quite ripe. You can slice it up and you can just add it to some amazake, or even just press some fresh koji against it and create a level of sweetness that, you know, really accents the flavor of the fruit, plus makes it more enjoyable. I mean, we all do these things, like, you know, when you have some, you know, some strawberries and you put some cream with maybe a drizzle of honey over it. It's in that same category of making adjustments to make food more tasty and more interesting. And koji does that just by, you know, putting it up against some cut fruit, and it's pretty awesome.
Right. So, yeah, you mentioned a shokojin and amazake. So these are in the book. And basically, I mean, I tried shokoji. It's, Jeremy and Rich get koji in the form of spores. And you have they have to grow. You have to grow it, which is not easy, probably. And for safety, you know, you have to have a very clean environment, too. But what I did was I went to a Japanese grocery store. I can just buy it on Amazon, too, and get some already grown koji, right? And you can make mazake and the shokoji easily.
Yeah, you can use those ingredients just to follow our recipes. I mean, you just add first, you know, a very simple shio koji. You just add equal parts koji to water, and we recommend 5% salt on top of the entire amount. So you just measure them all by weight so you can get an accurate number, and just let it sit on your counter for about a week, and it's ready to use. I mean, if you want to make it go a little bit faster, you can blend all the ingredients. And if you're to make an amazake, you just follow the same steps. So we have a basic amazake you can make is you just take one part koji, one part cooked grain. It could be a rice. It could be anything that you want that's desirable to you. We talked about oat milk. Rye works really well. I mean, all of these different grains create different flavors and aromatics that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. And then you add two parts water to it, and then, and you let it sit on your counter for 3 to 5 days, depending how sweet and then how much, lacto or acidic flavor you want from the fermentation. And then that's ready to go as well. So you can use these products fairly quickly and get them rolling. And then it also, if you can put it in a warmer environment, on the order of, you know, maybe, you know, putting it at, maybe in an incubator for a little bit, just to warm up by like 20 degrees F, you can accelerate the process such that you can get it in a day or two.
Right. Wow. So, well, because it's koji is such an ancient mold or ingredient, then there shouldn't be any complexity in using it. So once you know what it is, probably it's very easy to utilize.
Yeah, and even going to like a Japanese market or looking on the internet, you can find there are companies out of Japan most definitely that make shio koji and amazake already sealed up in a package, ready to go. So if you're someone who's interested in getting into koji, but you don't necessarily want to grow the mold at home or aren't sure that you want to invest in creating it and using it in some of the more complex ways, you can buy, like I said, the pre-made shio koji in a little, I think it's an 8-ounce package. I've seen them. And you can use that in your food. You can marinate a piece of meat in it before you cook it. You could drizzle that over some vegetables as you're sauteing them in a pan. You can experience it that way and then make, decisions of, oh, I'd like to make this at home.
Right. And it, it took me, I used the prepackaged one, and it took me 15 minutes to, before I, you know, let them grow. And I left it like 5 days. And yeah, I just used the marinade, and I, by itself, you can eat it. It's so tasty. It so, yeah. And in your book also, there's so many interesting ingredients. Oh, the recipes are such as, I was fascinated by the Amazake white bread, and also Amazake cultured cream, and all those things. And you, you know, which you mentioned, oat milk, I really have to try that. So this is amazing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. We're glad that you're excited about it.
So, but why do you think chefs all over the world are suddenly discovering koji?
Well, I think that the chefs have been aware of koji for a long time, just as a result of the fine dining scene, and you know, and chefs being interested in what's going on in Japan and in Asia in general, that they've discovered how quickly something can be converted into something delicious, especially because it's part of our, you know, pretty much part of everyone's culinary palate that most people have tried soy sauce. And if you think about the ingredients of soy sauce, it is simply rice, soybeans, wheat, toasted wheat, and salt and water. And to be able to create something so delicious just by adding a particular mold is amazing. And people understand that from this, understand that it's very simple to do, to be able to create these amazing flavors. And artisans have been doing it for years, and being able to leverage these things just with very, very few tools, you can get to this point of being able to create something delicious with a base product that makes it taste more like itself and really brilliant without using all that much work. I mean, if you think about having to marinate something to accentuate the base flavor of itself, you would have to use an extraordinary amount of ingredients and skill to be able to achieve that. Whereas with koji, you just put it on and leave it for a few hours. And right. I think that's part of the desire, you know, that's part of the magic of it, is that it's so easy to do with very little, a relatively amount of little effort.
Mm. And I believe because it's a fermented product and with good enzymes, probably it's good for your health too. We create your better microbiome, and that's my guess. But yeah, so this is amazing. So where can we buy your book? The title is again, The Koji Alchemy. So we cannot go to bookstores, but I'm sure it's available everywhere.
Well, you'd be surprised. So you can go directly to our publisher, which is Chelsea Green Publishing. They are actually shipping it faster than Amazon is right now with everything going on with COVID. Mm. We've been hearing from some people that some of the Amazon orders, there's some shipping delays based on everything that's going on, but the people that have been buying it directly from the publisher have been getting the book within just a couple of days, just standard shipping. The other thing to keep in mind too, at least here in Cleveland in Ohio, the local bookstores, even though they're not open to the public, they are still able to ship a book. So Visual Voice Books here in Cleveland, Ohio, a lot of people locally have contacted them via email or phone and been able to order the book from them. And, you know, right now, something like that is so important, supporting your local bookseller, because they can still get a book out to you in the mail, even though you can't go into the store and buy it right now. So being able to help them out and, you know, them be able to make some money and keep their shops open, hopefully, with everything that's going on, is something great to do. So we're really encouraging people to look at their favorite local bookstore, give them a call. Most of them, I'm willing to bet, are going to be more than happy to order the book for you and get it shipped to your house safely.
Great.
And for me in the Boston area, you can order it from Porter Square Books.
Mm. All right.
Wow, that's an unexpected promotion of local small businesses. So I love that. So listeners, the book is again Coach Alchemy, Rediscovering the Magic of Malt-Based Fermentation from Chelsea Green Publishing. So where can we find you guys' updates online?
We typically post what we're doing just about every day on our personal handles on Instagram. Mine is rcookquest and Jeremy is TM Gastronaut.
Great. All right. So I think we need to have another episode to discover more about Koji. So hopefully you can come back and next time in the studio.
Yeah, I have a great idea. So when we're able to come out, Rich and I will come to New York. We'll bring a whole bunch of Koji foods for us, and we'll do a show. We'll do a Koji tasting show.
Perfect. I can't wait.
And we'd love to have you bring your Koji mix.
Okay. Yeah. I have to work on that, but I have your book, so I'm very hopeful.
And they have to be non-traditional.
Okay. All right. Supporting creativity. Well, I'll get that from the book.
No pressure.
Well, I will work on it. So, Rich, Jeremy, thank you for joining us today, and be safe.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikoatayama.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org and iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization, driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.